notes penned so painstakingly were no longer legible. Merthyn went there to check how upright the wall was by dangling a lead pointer on a long string from the window, and while there he made a discovery. There were cracks in the wall. Cracks were not necessarily a sign of weakness. Their meaning had to be interpreted by an experienced eye. All buildings moved, and cracks might simply show how a structure was adjusting to accommodate change. Merthyn judged that most of the cracks in the wall of this storeroom were benign, but there was one that puzzled him by its shape. It did not look normal. A second glance told him that someone had taken advantage of a natural crack to loosen a small stone. He removed the stone. He realized immediately that he had found someone's secret hiding place. The space behind the stone was a thief's stash. He took the objects out one by one. There was a woman's brooch with a large green stone, a silver buckle, a silk shawl, and a scroll with a psalm written on it. Right at the back, he found the object that gave him the clue to the identity of the thief. It was the only thing in the hole that had no monetary value. A simple piece of polished wood. It had letters carved into its surface that read, M. P-H-M-N. Amat. M was just an initial. Amat was the Latin for loves. And P-H-M-N was surely Philemon. Someone whose name began with M, boy or girl, had once loved Philemon and given him this, and he had hidden it with his stolen treasures. Since childhood, Philemon had been rumored to be light-fingered. Around him, things went missing. It seemed that this was where he hid them. Merthyn imagined him coming up here alone, perhaps at night, to pull out the stone and gloat over his loot. No doubt it was a kind of sickness. There had never been any rumors about Philemon having lovers. Like his mentor Godwin, he seemed to be one of that small minority of men in whom the need for sexual love was weak. But someone had fallen for him at some time, and he cherished the memory. Merthyn replaced the objects, putting them back exactly the way he had found them. He had a good memory for that sort of thing. He replaced the loose stone. Then, thoughtfully, he left the room and went back down the spiral staircase. Ralph was surprised when Philippa came home. It was a rare fine day in a wet summer, and he would have liked to be out hawking, but to his anger he was not able to go. The harvest was about to begin, and most of the 20 or 30 stewards, bailiffs and reeves in the earldom needed to see him urgently. They all had the same problem. Crops ripening in the fields, and insufficient men and women to harvest them. He could do nothing to help. He had taken every opportunity to prosecute laborers who defied the ordinance by leaving their villages in search of higher wages, but those few who could be caught just paid the fine out of their earnings and ran off again. So his bailiffs had to make do. However, they all wanted to explain their difficulties to him, and he had no choice but to listen and give his approval to their makeshift plans. The hall was full of people, bailiffs, knights and men-at-arms, a couple of priests, and a dozen or more loitering servants. When they all went quiet, Ralph suddenly heard the rooks outside, their harsh call sounding like a warning. He looked up and saw Philippa in the doorway. She spoke first to the servants. "Martha! This table is still dirty from dinner. Fetch hot water and scrub it, now. Dicky, I've just seen the Earl's favourite courser covered with what looks like yesterday's mud, and you're here whittling a stick. Get back to the stables where you belong and clean up that horse. You, boy, put that puppy outside. It's just pissed on the floor. The only dog allowed in the hall is the Earl's Mastiff. You know that." The servants were galvanised into action, even those to whom she had not spoken, suddenly finding work to do. Ralph did not mind Philippa issuing orders to the domestic servants. They got lazy without a mistress to harry them. She came up to him and made a deep curtsy, as was only appropriate after a long absence. She did not offer to kiss him. He said neutrally, "This is unexpected." Philippa said irritably, "I shouldn't have had to make the journey at all." Ralph groaned inwardly. "What brings you here?" he said. Whatever it was, there would be trouble, he felt sure. "My manor of Ingsby." Philippa had a small number of properties of her own, a few villages in Gloucestershire that paid tribute to her rather than to the Earl. Since she had gone to live at the nunnery, the bailiffs from these villages had been visiting her at Kingsbridge Priory, Ralph knew, and accounting to her directly for their dues. But Ingsby was an awkward exception. The manor paid tribute to him, and he passed it on to her, which he had forgotten to do since she left. "Damn," he said, "it slipped my mind." "That's all right," she said. "You've got a lot to think about." That was surprisingly conciliatory. She went upstairs to the private chamber, and he returned to his work. Half a year of separation had improved her a little, he thought, as another bailiff enumerated the fields of ripening corn and bemoaned the shortage of reapers. Still, he hoped she did not plan to stay long. Lying beside her at night was like sleeping with a dead cow. She reappeared at supper time. She sat next to Ralph and spoke politely to several visiting knights during the meal. She was as cool and reserved as ever. There was no affection, not even any humor, but he saw no sign of the implacable icy hatred she had shown after their wedding. It was gone, or at least deeply hidden. When the meal was over, she retired again, leaving him to drink with the knights. He considered the possibility that she was planning to come back permanently, but in the end he dismissed the idea. She would never love him, or even like him. It was just that a long absence had blunted the edge of her resentment. The underlying feeling would probably never leave her. He assumed she would be asleep when he went upstairs, but, to his surprise, she was at the writing desk, in an ivory-coloured linen nightgown, a single candle throwing a soft light over her proud features and thick, dark hair. In front of her was a long letter in a girlish hand, which he guessed was from Odila, now the Countess of Monmouth. Philippa was penning a reply. Like most aristocrats, she dictated business letters to a clerk, but wrote personal ones herself. He stepped into the garderobe, then came out and took off his outer clothing. It was summer, and he normally slept in his underdrawers. Philippa finished her letter, stood up, and knocked over the jar of ink on the desk. She jumped back, too late. Somehow it fell towards her, disfiguring her white nightdress with a broad black stain. She cursed. He was mildly amused. She was so prissily particular that it was funny to see her splashed with ink. She hesitated for a moment, then pulled the nightdress off over her head. He was startled. She was not normally quick to take off her clothes. She had been disconcerted by the ink, he realized. He stared at her naked body. She had put on a little weight at the nunnery. Her breasts seemed larger and rounder than before. Her belly had a slight but discernible bulge, and her hips had an attractive, swelling curve. To his surprise, he felt aroused. She bent down to mop the ink off the tiled floor with her bundled-up nightgown. Her breasts swayed as she rubbed the tiles. She turned, and he got a full view of her generous behind. If he had not known her better, he would have suspected her of trying to inflame him. But Philippa had never tried to inflame anyone, let alone him. She was just awkward and embarrassed, and that made it even more stimulating to stare at her exposed nakedness while she wiped the floor. It was several weeks since he had been with a woman, and the last one had been a very unsatisfactory whore in Salisbury. By the time Philippa stood up, he had an erection. She saw him staring. "Don't look at me," she said. "Go to bed." She threw the soiled garment into the laundry hamper. She went to the clothes press and lifted its lid. She had left most of her clothes here when she went to Kingsbridge. It was not considered seemly to dress richly when living in a nunnery, even for noble guests. She found another nightdress. Ralph raked her with his eyes as she lifted it out. He stared at her uplifted breasts and the mound of her sex with its dark hair, and his mouth went dry. She caught his look. "Don't you touch me," she said. If she had not said that, he would probably have lain down and gone to sleep, but her swift rejection stung him. "I'm the Earl of Shiring, and you're my wife," he said. "I'll touch you any time I like." "You wouldn't dare," she said, and she turned away to put on the gown. That angered him. As she lifted the garment to put it on over her head, he slapped her bottom. It was a hard slap on bare skin, and he could tell that it hurt her. She jumped and cried out. "So much for not daring," he said. She turned to him, a protest on her lips, and on impulse he punched her in the mouth. She was knocked back and fell to the floor. Her hands flew to her mouth, and blood seeped through her fingers. But she was on her back, naked, with her legs spread, and he could see the triangle of hair at the fork of her thighs, with its cleft slightly parted in what looked like an invitation. He fell on her. She wriggled furiously, but he was bigger than she, and strong. He overcame her resistance effortlessly. A moment later he was inside her. She was dry, but somehow that excited him. It was all over quite quickly. He rolled off her, panting. After a few moments, he looked at her. There was blood on her mouth. She did not look back at him. Her eyes were closed. Yet it seemed to him that there was a curious expression on her face. He thought about it for a while, until he worked it out. Then he was even more puzzled than before. She looked triumphant. Merthyr knew that Philippa had returned to Kingsbridge, because he saw her maid in the Bell. He expected his lover to come to his house that night, and was disappointed when she did not. No doubt she felt awkward, he thought. No lady would be comfortable with what she had done, even though the reasons were compelling, even though the man she loved knew and understood. Another night went by without her appearing. Then it was Sunday, and he felt sure he would see her in church. But she did not come to the service. It was almost unheard of for the nobility to miss Sunday Mass. What had kept her away? After the service, he sent Lola home with Arne and Em, then went across the green to the old hospital. On the upper floor were three rooms for important guests. He took the outside staircase. In the corridor he came face to face with Caris. She did not bother to ask what he was doing here. "The Countess doesn't want you to see her, but you probably should," she said. Merthyr noted the odd turn of phrase. Not, "The Countess doesn't want to see you," but, "The Countess doesn't want you to see her." He looked at the bowl Caris was carrying. It contained a blood-stained rag. Fear struck his heart. "What's wrong?" "Nothing too serious," Caris said. "The baby is unharmed." "Thank God. You're the father, of course. Please don't ever let anyone hear you say that." She looked sad. "All the years you and I were together, and I only conceived that one time." He looked away. "Which room is she in?" "Sorry to talk about myself. I'm the last thing you're interested in. Lady Philippa is in the middle room." He caught the poorly suppressed grief in her voice and paused, despite his anxiety for Philippa. He touched Caris's arm. "Please don't believe I'm not interested in you," he said. "I'll always care what happens to you, and whether you're happy." She nodded, and tears came to her eyes. "I know," she said. "I'm being selfish. Go and see Philippa." He left Caris and entered the middle room. Philippa was kneeling on the prie-dieu, with her back to him. He interrupted her prayers. "Are you all right?" She stood up and turned to him. Her face was a mess. Her lips were swollen to three times their normal size and badly scabbed. He guessed that Caris had been bathing the wound, hence the bloody rag. "What happened?" he said. "Can you speak?" She nodded. "I sound queer, but I can talk." Her voice was a mumble, but comprehensible. "How badly are you hurt?" "My face looks awful, but it's not serious. Other than that, I'm fine." He put his arms around her. She laid her head on his shoulder. He waited, holding her. After a while, she began to cry. He stroked her hair and her back while she shook with sobs. He said, "There, there," and kissed her forehead, but he did not try to silence her. Slowly her weeping subsided. He said, "Can I kiss your lips?" She nodded. "Gently." He brushed them with his own. He tasted almonds. Caris had smeared the cuts with oil. "Tell me what happened," he said.
"It worked. He was fooled. He will be sure it's his baby."
He touched her mouth with his fingertip. "And he did this?"
"Don't be angry. I tried to provoke him, and I succeeded.
Be glad he hit me." "Glad? Why?"
"Because he thinks he had to force me. He believes I would not have submitted without violence. He has no inkling that I intended to seduce him. He will never suspect the truth, which means I'm safe. And so is our baby."
He put his hand on her belly. "But why didn't you come and see me?
Looking like this?"
"I want to be with you even more when you're hurt." He moved his hand to her breast. "Besides, I've missed you." She took his hand away.
"I can't go from one to the other like a whore."
Oh, he had not thought of it that way.
"Do you understand?"
"I think so." He could see that a woman would feel cheap, although a man might be proud of doing exactly the same thing. "But how long?" She sighed and moved away.
"It's not how long."
"What do you mean?" "We've agreed to tell the world that this is Ralph's baby, and I've made sure he'll believe that. Now he's going to want to raise it." Merthyn was dismayed. "I hadn't thought about the details, but I imagined you would continue to live in the priory."
"Ralph won't allow his child to be raised in a nunnery, especially if it's a boy."
"So what will you do? Go back to Earl's Castle?"
"Yes."
The child was nothing yet, of course. Not a person, not even a baby, just a swelling in Philippa's belly. But all the same, Merthyn felt a stab of grief. Lola had become the great joy of his life, and he had been looking forward eagerly to another child. But at least he had Philippa for a little while longer. "When will you go?" he asked.
"Immediately," she said.
She saw the look on his face, and tears came to her eyes.
"I can't tell you how sorry I am, but I would just feel wrong, making love to you and planning to return to Ralph. It would be the same with any two men. The fact that your brother's just makes it uglier."
His eyes blurred with tears. "So it's over with us already?
Now?"
She nodded.
"And there's another thing I have to tell you. One more reason why we can never be lovers again. I've confessed my adultery."
Merthyn knew that Philippa had her own personal confessor, as was appropriate for a high-ranking noblewoman. Since she came to Kingsbridge, he had been living with the monks, a welcome addition to their thinned ranks. So now she had told him of her affair. Merthyn hoped he could keep the secrets of the confessional. Philippa said,
"I have received absolution, but I must not continue the sin."
Merthyn nodded. She was right. They had both sinned. She had betrayed her husband, and he had betrayed his brother. She had an excuse. She had been forced into the marriage. He had none. A beautiful woman had fallen in love with him, and he had loved her back, even though he had no right. The yearning ache of grief and loss he was feeling now was the natural consequence of such behavior. He looked at her, the cool gray-green eyes, the smashed mouth, the ripe body, and realized that he had lost her. Perhaps he had never really had her. In any case, it had always been wrong, and now it was over. He tried to speak, to say goodbye, but his throat seemed to seize up and nothing came out. He could hardly see for crying. He turned away, fumbled for the door, and somehow got out of the room. A nun was coming along the corridor carrying a jug. He could not see who it was, but he recognized Caris's voice when she said, "Merthin, are you all right?" He made no reply. He went in the opposite direction and passed through the door and down the outside staircase. Weeping openly, not caring who saw, he walked across the cathedral green, down the main street, and across the bridge to his island. Chapter 80. September 1350 was cold and wet, but all the same there was a sense of euphoria. As damp sheaves of wheat were gathered in the surrounding countryside, only one person died of the plague in Kingsbridge, Marge Taylor, a dressmaker, 60 years old. No one caught the disease in October, November, or December. It seemed to have vanished, Merthin thought gratefully, at least for the time being. The age-old migration of enterprising, restless people from countryside to town had been reversed during the plague, but now it recommenced. They came to Kingsbridge, moved into empty houses, fixed them up, and paid rent to the priory. Some started new businesses, bakeries, breweries, candle manufactories, to replace the old ones that had disappeared when the owners and all their heirs died off. Merthin, as alderman, had made it easier to open a shop or a market stall, sweeping away the lengthy process of obtaining permission that had been imposed by the priory. The weekly market grew busier. One by one, Merthin rented out the shops, houses, and taverns he had built on Leopard Island. His tenants, either enterprising newcomers or existing tradesmen who wanted a better location. The road across the island, between the two bridges, had become an extension of the main street, and therefore prime commercial property, as Merthin had foreseen 12 years ago, when people had thought he was mad to take the barren rock as payment for his work on the bridge. Winter drew in, and once again the smoke from thousands of fires hung over the town in a low brown cloud. But the people still worked and shopped, ate and drank, played dice in taverns and went to church on Sundays. The Guildhall saw the first Christmas Eve banquet since the parish guild had become a borough guild. Merthin invited the prior and prioress. They no longer had power to overrule the merchants, but they were still among the most important people in town. Philemon came, but Caris declined the invitation. She had become worryingly withdrawn. Merthin sat next to Madge Webber. She was now the richest merchant and the largest employer in Kingsbridge, perhaps in the whole county. She was deputy alderman, and probably should have been alderman, but that it was unusual to have a woman in that position. Among Merthin's many enterprises was a workshop turning out the treadle looms that had improved the quality of Kingsbridge scarlet. Madge bought more than half his production, but enterprising merchants came from as far away as London to place orders for the rest. The looms were complex pieces of machinery that had to be made accurately and assembled with precision, so Merthin had to employ the best carpenters available. But he priced the finished product at more than double what it cost him to make, and still people could hardly wait to give him the money. Several people had hinted that he should marry Madge, but the idea did not tempt him or her. She had never been able to find a man to match Mark, who had had the physique of a giant and the disposition of a saint. She had always been chunky, but these days she was quite fat. Now in her 40s, she was growing into one of those women who looked like barrels, almost the same width all the way from shoulders to bottom. Eating and drinking well were now her chief pleasures, Mirthin thought, as he watched her tuck into gingered ham with a sauce made of apples and cloves. That, and making money. At the end of the meal they had a mulled wine called Hippocras. Madge took a long draught, belched, and moved closer to Mirthin on the bench. "We have to do something about the hospital," she said. "Oh?" He was not aware of a problem. "Now that the plague has ended, I would have thought people didn't have much need of a hospital." "Of course they do," she said briskly. "They still get fevers and bellyache and cancer. Women want to get pregnant and can't, or they suffer complications giving birth. Children burn themselves and fall out of trees. Men are thrown by their horses, or knifed by their enemies, or have their heads broken by angry wives." "Yes, I get the picture," Mirthin said, amused by her garrulousness. "What's the problem?" "Nobody will go to the hospital any more. They don't like Brother Syme, and, more importantly, they don't trust his learning. While we were all coping with the plague, he was at Oxford reading ancient textbooks, and he still prescribes remedies such as bleeding and cupping that no one believes in any more. They want Caris, but she never appears." "What do people do when they're sick, if they don't go to the hospital?" "They see Matthew Barber, or Silas Pothecary, or a newcomer called Marla Wisdom, who specializes in women's problems." "So what's worrying you?" "They're starting to mutter about the priory. If they don't get help from the monks and nuns, they say, why should they pay towards building the tower?" "Oh." The tower was a huge project. No individual could possibly finance it. A combination of monastery, nunnery, and city funds was the only way to pay for it. If the town defaulted, the project could be threatened. "Yes, I see," said Mirthin worriedly. "That is a problem." It had been a good year for most people, Caris thought as she sat through the Christmas Day service. People were adjusting to the devastation of the plague with astonishing speed. As well as bringing terrible suffering and a near breakdown of civilized life, the disease had provided the opportunity for a shake-up. Almost half the population had died, by her calculations, but one effect was that her remaining peasants were farming only the most fertile soils, so each man produced more. Despite the ordinance of laborers and the efforts of noblemen such as Earl Ralph to enforce it, she was gratified to see that people continued to move to where the pay was highest, which was usually where the land was most productive. Grain was plentiful, and herds of cattle and sheep were growing again. The nunnery was thriving, and because Caris had reorganized the monks' affairs as well as the nuns after the flight of Godwin, the monastery was now more prosperous than it had been for 100 years. Wealth created wealth, and good times in the countryside brought more business to the towns, so Kingsbridge craftsmen and shopkeepers were beginning to return to their former affluence. As the nuns left the church at the end of the service, Prior Philemon spoke to her. "I need to talk to you, Mother Prioress. Would you come to my house?" There had been a time when she would have politely acceded to such a request without hesitation, but those days were over. "No," she said, "I don't think so." He reddened immediately. "You can't refuse to speak to me." "I didn't. I refused to go to your palace. I declined to be summoned before you like a subordinate. What do you want to talk about?" "The hospital. There have been complaints." "Speak to Brother Syme. He's in charge of it, as you well know." "Is there no reasoning with you?" he said exasperatedly. "If Syme could solve the problem, I would be talking to him, not you." By now they were in the monks' cloisters. Caris sat on the low wall around the quadrangle. The stone was cold. "We can talk here. What do you have to say to me?" Philemon was annoyed, but he gave in. He stood in front of her, and now he was the one who seemed like a subordinate. He said, "The townspeople are unhappy about the hospital." "I'm not surprised." "Mirthin complained to me at the guild's Christmas dinner. They don't come here any more, but see charlatans like Silas Pothecary. He's no more of a charlatan than Syme. Philemon realized that several novices were standing nearby, listening to the argument. "Go away, all of you," he said. "Get to your studies." They scurried off. Philemon said to Charis, "The townspeople think you ought to be at the hospital." "So do I, but I won't follow Syme's methods. At best, his cures have no effect. Much of the time they make patients worse. That's why people no longer come here when they're ill." "Your new hospital has so few patients that we're using it as a guest house. Doesn't that bother you?" That jibe went home. Charis swallowed and looked away. "It breaks my heart," she said quietly. "Then come back. Figure out a compromise with Syme. You worked under monk physicians in the early days when you first came here. Brother Joseph was the senior doctor then. He had the same training as Syme." "You're right. In those days, we felt that the monks sometimes did more harm than good, but we could work with them. Most of the time we didn't call them in at all. We just did what we thought best. When they did attend, we didn't always follow their instructions exactly. You can't believe they were always wrong." "No, sometimes they cured people. I remember Joseph opening a man's skull and draining accumulated fluid that had been causing unbearable headaches. It was very impressive. So do the same now. It's no longer possible. Syme put an end to that, didn't he? He moved his books and equipment into the pharmacy and took charge of the hospital, and I'm sure he did so with your encouragement. In fact, it was probably your idea." She could tell from Philemon's expression that she was right. "You and he plotted to push me out. You succeeded, and now you're suffering the consequences. We could go back to the old system. I'll make Syme move out." She shook her head. "There have been other changes. I've learned a lot from the plague. I'm surer than ever that the physician's methods can be fatal. I won't kill people for the sake of a compromise with you." "You don't realize how much is at stake." He had a faintly smug look. So, there was something else. She had been wondering why he had brought this up. It was not like him to fret about the hospital. He had never cared much for the work of healing. He was interested only in what would raise his status and defend his fragile pride. "All right," she said. "What have you got up your sleeve?" "The townspeople are talking about cutting off funds for the new tower. Why should they pay extra to the cathedral, they say, when they're not getting what they want from us? And now that the town is a borough, I, as prior, can no longer enforce the payment. And if they don't pay, your beloved Merthin will have to abandon his pet project," Philemon said triumphantly. Charis could see that he thought this was his trump card, and indeed there had been a time when the revelation would have jolted her. But no longer. "Merthin isn't my beloved any more, is he?" she said. "You put a stop to that, too." A look of panic crossed his face. "But the bishop has set his heart on this tower. You can't put that at risk." Charis stood up. "Can't I?" she said. "Why not?" She turned away, heading for the nunnery. He was flabbergasted. He called after her. "How can you be so reckless?" She was going to ignore him. Then she changed her mind and decided to explain. She turned back. "You see, all that I ever held dear has been taken from me," she said in a matter-of-fact tone. "And when you've lost everything..." Her facade began to crumble, and her voice broke, but she made herself carry on. "When you've lost everything, you've got nothing to lose." The first snow fell in January. It formed a thick blanket on the roof of the cathedral, smoothed out the delicate carving of the spires, and masked the faces of the angels and saints sculpted over the west door. The new masonry of the tower foundations had been covered with straw to insulate the new mortar against winter frost, and now the snow overlaid the straw. There were few fireplaces in a priory. The kitchen had fires, of course, which was why work in kitchens was always popular with novices. But there was no fire in the cathedral, where the monks and nuns spent 7 or 8 hours every day. When churches burned down, it was usually because some desperate monk had brought a charcoal brazier into the building, and a spark had flown from the fire to the timber ceiling. When not in church or labouring, the monks and nuns were supposed to walk and read in the cloisters, which were out of doors. The only concession to their comfort was the warming room, a small chamber off the cloisters, where a fire was lit in the most severe weather. They were allowed to come into the warming room from the cloisters for short periods. As usual, Caris ignored rules and traditions, and permitted nuns to wear woolen hose in the winter. She did not believe that God needed his servants to get chilblains. Bishop Henri was so worried about the hospital, or rather about the threat to his tower, that he drove from Shiring to Kingsbridge through the snow. He came in a charrette, a heavy wooden cart with a waxed canvas cover and cushioned seats. Canon Claude and Archdeacon Lloyd came with him. They paused at the prior's palace only long enough to dry their clothes and drink a warming cup of wine, before summoning a crisis meeting with Philemon, Syme, Caris, Una, Merthin, and Madge. Caris knew it would be a waste of time, but she went anyway. It was easier than refusing, which would have required her to sit in the nunnery and deal with endless messages begging, commanding, and threatening her. She looked at the snowflakes falling past the glazed windows, as the bishop drearily summarized a quarrel in which she really had no interest. "This crisis has been brought about by the disloyal and disobedient attitude of Mother Caris," Henri said. That stung her into a response. "I worked in the hospital here for 10 years, she said. "My work, and the work of Mother Cecilia before me, are what made it so popular with the townspeople." She pointed a rude finger at the bishop. "You changed it. Don't try to blame others. You sat in that chair and announced that Brother Syme would henceforth be in charge. Now you should take responsibility for the consequences of your foolish decision." "You must obey me," he said, his voice rising to a screech in frustration. "You are a nun! You have taken a vow!" The grating sound disturbed the cat, Archbishop, and it stood up and walked out of the room. "I realize that," Caris said. "It puts me in an intolerable position." She spoke without forethought, but as the words came out, she realized they were not really ill-considered. In fact, they were the fruit of months of brooding. "I can no longer serve God in this way," she went on, her voice calm but her heart pounding. "That is why I have decided to renounce my vows and leave the nunnery." Henri actually stood up.
"You will not," he shouted. "I will not release you from your holy vows."
"I expect God will, though," she said, scarcely disguising her contempt. That made him angrier.
"This notion that individuals can deal with God is wicked heresy. There has been too much of such loose talk since the plague."
"Do you think that might have happened because, when people approached the church for help during the plague, they so often found that its priests and monks," here she looked at Philemon, "had fled like cowards?" Henri held up a hand to stifle Philemon's indignant response.
"We may be fallible, but all the same, it is only through the church and its priests that men and women may approach God."
"You would think that, of course," Caris said, "but that doesn't make it right."
"You're a devil!"
Canon Claude intervened.
"All things considered, my Lord Bishop, a public quarrel between yourself and Caris would not be helpful."
He gave her a friendly smile. He had been well disposed towards her ever since the day she had caught him and the bishop kissing, and had said nothing about it.
"Her present non-cooperation must be set against many years of dedicated, sometimes heroic service, and the people love her."
Henri said, "But what if we do release her from her vows? How would that solve their problem?"
At this point, Merthin spoke for the first time. "I have a suggestion," he said. Everyone looked at him. He said, "Let the town build a new hospital. I will donate a large site on Leper Island. Let it be staffed by a convent of nuns quite separate from the priory, a new group. They will be under the spiritual authority of the Bishop of Shiring, of course, but have no connection with the Prior of Kingsbridge or any of the physicians at the monastery. Let the new hospital have a lay patron who would be a leading citizen of the town, chosen by the guild, and would appoint the prioress." They were all quiet for a long moment, letting this radical proposal sink in. Caris was thunderstruck. A new hospital, on Leper Island, paid for by the townspeople, staffed by a new order of nuns, having no connection with the priory. She looked around the group. Philemon and Syme clearly hated the idea. Henri, Claude, and Lloyd just looked bemused. At last the bishop said, "The patron will be very powerful, representing the townspeople, paying the bills, and appointing the prioress. Whoever plays that role will control the hospital." "Yes," said Merthin. "If I authorize a new hospital, will the townspeople be willing to resume paying for the tower?" Madge Webber spoke for the first time. "If the right patron is appointed, yes." "And who should it be?" said Henri. Caris realized that everyone was looking at her. A few hours later, Caris and Merthin wrapped themselves in heavy cloaks, put on boots, and walked through the snow to the island, where he showed her the site he had in mind. It was on the west side, not far from his house, overlooking the river. She was still dizzy from the sudden change in her life. She was to be released from her vows as a nun. She would become a normal citizen again, after almost 12 years. She found she could contemplate leaving the priory without anguish. The people she had loved were all dead. Mother Cecilia, old Julie, Mayor, Tilly. She liked Sister Joan and Sister Una well enough, but it was not the same. And she would still be in charge of a hospital. Having the right to appoint and dismiss the prioress of the new institution, she would be able to run the place according to the new thinking that had grown out of the plague. The bishop had agreed to everything. "I think we should use the cloister layout again," Merthin said. "It seemed to work really well for the short time you were in charge." She stared at the sheet of unmarked snow and marveled at his ability to imagine walls and rooms where she could see only whiteness. "The entrance arch was used almost like a hall," she said. "It was the place where people waited and where the nuns first examined the patients before deciding what to do with them." "You would like it larger?" "I think it should be a real reception hall." "All right." She was bemused. "This is hard to believe. Everything has turned out just as I would have wanted it." He nodded. "That's how I worked it out."
"Really?"
"I asked myself what you would wish for. Then I figured out how to achieve it." She stared at him. He had said it lightly, as if merely explaining the reasoning process that had led him to his conclusions. He seemed to have no idea how momentous it was to her that he should be thinking about her wishes and how to achieve them. She said, "Has Philippa had the baby yet?"
"Yes, a week ago."
"What did she have?"
"A boy."
"Congratulations." "Have you seen him?"
"No. As far as the world is concerned, I'm only his uncle. But Ralph sent me a letter."
"Have they named him?"
"Roland, after the old earl."
Caris changed the subject. "The river water isn't very pure this far downstream. A hospital really needs clean water. I'll lay a pipe to bring you water from farther upstream." The snowfall eased and then stopped, and they had a clear view of the island. She smiled at him.
"You have the answer to everything."
He shook his head. "These are the easy questions. Clean water, airy rooms, a reception hall. And what are the difficult ones? He turned to face her. There were snowflakes in his red beard. He said, questions like, does she still love me? They stared at one another for a long moment. Karis was happy. Part 7. March to November 1361. Chapter 81. Wulfric at 40 was still the handsomest man Gwenda had ever seen. There were threads of silver now in his tawny hair, but they just made him look wise as well as strong. When he was young, his broad shoulders had tapered dramatically to a narrow waist, whereas nowadays the taper was not so sharp, nor the waist so slim, but he could still do the work of two men, and he would always be 2 years younger than she. She thought she had changed less. She had the kind of dark hair that did not go grey until late in life. She was no heavier than she had been 20 years ago, although since having the children her breasts and belly were not quite as taut as formerly. It was only when she looked at her son Davy, at his smooth skin and the restless spring in his step, that she felt her years. Now 20, he looked like a male version of herself at that age. She, too, had had a face with no lines, and she had walked with a jaunty stride. A lifetime of working in the fields in all weathers had wrinkled her hands, and given her cheeks a raw redness just beneath the skin, and taught her to walk slowly and conserve her strength. Davy was small, like her, and shrewd and secretive. Since he was little, she had never been sure what he was thinking. Sam was the opposite, big and strong, not clever enough to be deceitful, but with a mean streak that Gwenda blamed on his real father, Ralph Fitzgerald. For several years now, the two boys had been working alongside Wulfric in the fields, until 2 weeks ago, when Sam had vanished. They knew why he had gone. All winter long he had been talking about leaving Wigley and moving to a village where he could earn higher wages. He had disappeared the moment the spring ploughing began. Gwenda knew he was right about the wages. It was a crime to leave your village, or to accept pay higher than the levels of 1347, but all over the country, restless young men were flouting the law, and desperate farmers were hiring them. Landlords, such as Earl Ralph, could do little more than gnash their teeth. Sam had not said where he would go, and he had given no warning of his departure. If Davy had done the same, Gwenda would have known he had thought things out carefully and decided this was the best way. But she felt sure Sam had just followed an impulse. Someone had mentioned the name of a village, and he had woken up early the next morning and decided to go there immediately. She told herself not to worry. He was 22 years old, big and strong. No one was going to exploit him or ill-treat him. But she was his mother, and her heart ached. If she could not find him, no one else could, she figured, and that was good. All the same, she yearned to know where he was living, and if he was working for a decent master, and whether the people were kind to him. That winter, Wulfric had made a new light plough for the sandier acres of his holding, and one day in spring, Gwenda and he went to Northwood to buy an iron ploughshare, the one part they could not make for themselves. As usual, a small group of Wigley folk travelled together to the market. Jack and Eli, who operated the fulling mill for Madge Webber, were stocking up on supplies. They had no land of their own, so they bought all their food. Annet and her 18-year-old daughter Amabel had a dozen hens in a crate to sell at the market. The bailiff, Nathan, came too, with his grown son Jono, the childhood enemy of Sam. Annet still flirted with every good-looking man that crossed her path, and most of them grinned foolishly and flirted back. On the journey to Northwood, she chatted with Davy. Although he was less than half her age, she simpered and tossed her head and smacked his arm in mock reproach, just as if she were 22 rather than 42, She was not a girl any more, but she did not seem to know it, Gwenda thought sourly. Annette's daughter, Amabel, who was as pretty as Annette had once been, walked a little apart and seemed embarrassed by her mother. They reached Northwood at mid-morning. After Wulfric and Gwenda had made their purchase, they went to get their dinner at the Old Oak Tavern. For as long as Gwenda could remember, there had been a venerable oak outside the inn, a thick, squat tree with malformed branches that looked like a bent old man in winter and cast a welcome deep shade in summer. Her sons had chased one another around it as little boys, but it must have died or become unstable, for it had been chopped down, and now there was a stump as wide across as Wulfric was tall, used by the customers as a chair, a table, and, for one exhausted carter, a bed. Sitting on its edge, drinking ale from a huge tankard, was Harry Ploughman, the bailiff of Outhenby. Gwenda was taken back 12 years in a blink. What came to her mind, so forcefully that it brought tears to her eyes, was the hope that had lifted her heart as she and her family had set out, that morning in Northwood, to walk through the forest to Outhenby and a new life. The hope had been crushed in less than a fortnight, and Wulfric had been taken back to Wigley. The memory still made her burn with rage, with a rope around his neck. But Ralph had not had things all his own way since then. Circumstances had forced him to give Wulfric back the lands his father had held, which for Gwenda had been a savagely satisfying outcome, even though Wulfric had not been smart enough to win a free tenancy, unlike some of his neighbours. Gwenda was glad they were now tenants rather than labourers, and Wulfric had achieved his life's ambition. But she still longed for more independence, a tenancy free of feudal obligations, with a cash rent to pay, the whole agreement written down in the manorial records so that no lord could go back on it. It was what most serfs wanted, and more of them were getting it since the plague. Harry greeted them effusively and insisted on buying the mail. Soon after Wulfric and Gwenda's brief stay at Outhenby, Harry had been made bailiff by Mother Carris, and he still held that position, though Carris had long ago renounced her vows, and Mother Joan was now prioress. Outhenby continued prosperous, to judge by Harry's double chin and alehouse belly. As they were preparing to leave with the rest of the Wigley folk, Harry spoke to Gwenda in a low voice. "I've got a young man called Sam, labouring for me." Gwenda's heart leaped.
"My Sam?"
"Can't possibly be. No." She was bewildered. Why mention him in that case? But Harry tapped his wine-red nose, and Gwenda realized he was being enigmatic. "This Sam assures me that his lord is a Hampshire knight I've never heard of, who has given him permission to leave his village and work elsewhere, whereas your Sam's lord is Earl Ralph, who never lets his labourers go. Obviously, I couldn't employ your Sam." Gwenda understood. That would be Harry's story if official questions were asked.
"So he's in Outhenby?"
"Old Church, one of the smaller villages in the valley."
"Is he well?" she asked eagerly. "Thriving?"
"Thank God. A strong boy and a good worker, though he can be quarrelsome." She knew that.
"Is he living in a warm house?"
"Lodging with a good-hearted older couple, whose own son has gone to Kingsbridge to be apprenticed to a tanner." Gwenda had a dozen questions, but suddenly she noticed the bent figure of Nathan Reeve leaning on the doorpost of the tavern entrance, staring at her. She suppressed a curse. There was so much she wanted to know, but she was terrified of giving Nate even a clue to Sam's whereabouts. She needed to be content with what she had, and she was thrilled that at least she knew where he could be found. She turned away from Harry, trying to give the impression of casually ending an unimportant conversation. Out of the corner of her mouth she said, "Don't let him get into fights."
"I'll do what I can."
She waved perfunctorily and went after Wulfric. Walking home with the others, Wulfric carried the heavy plowshare on his shoulder with no apparent effort. Gwenda was bursting to tell him the news, but she had to wait until the group straggled out along the road, and she and her husband were separated from the others by a few yards. Then she repeated the conversation, speaking quietly. Wulfric was relieved. "At least we know where the ladder's got to," he said, breathing easily despite his load.
"I want to go to Athenby," Gwenda said.
Wulfric nodded. "I thought you might." He rarely challenged her, but now he expressed a misgiving.
"Dangerous, though. You'll have to make sure no one finds out where you've gone."
"Exactly. Nate mustn't know."
"How will you manage that?"
"He's sure to notice that I'm not in the village for a couple of days. We'll have to think of a story."
"We can say you're sick."
"Too risky. He'll probably come to the house to check."
"We could say you're at your father's place."
"Nate won't believe that. He knows I never stay there longer than I have to." She gnawed at a hangnail, racking her brains. In the ghost stories and fairy tales that people told around the fire on long winter evenings, the characters generally believed one another's lies without question, but real people were less easily duped.
"We could say I've gone to Kingsbridge," she said at last.
"What for?"
"To buy laying hens at the market, perhaps."
"You could buy hens from Annette." "I wouldn't buy anything from that bitch, and people know it."
"True. And Nate knows I've always been a friend of Caris, so he'll believe I could be staying with her."
"All right." It was not much of a story, but she could not think of anything better, and she was desperate to see her son. She left the next morning. She slipped out of the house before dawn, wrapped in a heavy cloak against the cold March wind. She walked softly through the village in pitch darkness, finding her way by touch and memory. She did not want to be seen and questioned before she had even left the neighborhood. But no one was up yet. Nathan Reeve's dog growled quietly, then recognized her tread, and she heard a soft thump as he wagged his tail against the side of his wooden kennel. She left the village and followed the road through the fields. When dawn broke, she was a mile away. She looked at the road behind her. It was empty. No one had followed her. She chewed a crust of stale bread for breakfast, then stopped at mid-morning at a tavern where the Wigley to Kingsbridge Road crossed the Northwood to Althenby Road. She recognized no one at the inn. She watched the door nervously as she ate a bowl of saltfish stew and drank a pint of cider. Every time someone came in, she got ready to hide her face, but it was always a stranger, and no one took any notice of her. She left quickly and set off on the road to Althenby. She reached the valley around mid-afternoon. It was 12 years since she had been here, but the place had not changed much. It had recovered from the plague remarkably quickly. Apart from some small children playing near the houses, most of the villagers were at work, ploughing and sowing, or looking after new lambs. They stared at her across the fields, knowing she was a stranger, wondering about her identity. Some of them would recognize her close up. She had been here for only 10 days, but those had been dramatic times, and they would remember. Villagers did not often see such excitement. She followed the River Authen as it meandered along the flat plain between two ranges of hills. She went from the main village through smaller settlements that she knew from the time she had spent here, as Ham, Shortacre, and Longwater, to the smallest and most remote, Oldchurch. Her excitement grew as she approached, and she even forgot her sore feet. Oldchurch was a hamlet with 30 hovels, none big enough to be a manor house or even a bailiff's home. However, in accordance with the name, there was an old church. It was several 100 years of age, Gwenda guessed. It had a squat tower and a short nave, all built of crude masonry, with tiny square windows placed apparently at random in the thick walls. She walked to the fields beyond. She ignored a group of shepherds in a distant pasture. Shrewd Harry Ploughman would not waste Big Sam on such light work. He would be harrowing, or clearing a ditch, or helping to manage the 8-ox plough team. Searching the three fields methodically, she looked for a crowd of mostly men, with warm hats and muddy boots and big voices to call to one another across the acres, and a young man ahead taller than the others. When she did not at first see her son, she suffered renewed apprehension. Had he already been recaptured? Had he moved to another village? She found him in a line of men digging manure into a newly ploughed strip. He had his coat off, despite the cold, and he was hefting an oak spade, the muscles of his back and arms bunching and shifting under his old linen shirt. Her heart filled with pride to see him, and to think that such a man had come from her diminutive body. They all looked up as she approached. The men stared at her in curiosity. Who was she, and what was she doing here? She walked straight up to Sam and embraced him, even though he stank of horse dung. "Hello, mother," he said, and all the other men laughed. She was puzzled by their hilarity. A wiry man with one empty eye socket said, "There, there, Sam, you'll be all right now," and they laughed again. Gwenda realized they thought it funny that a big man such as Sam should have his little mother come and check on him as if he were a wayward boy. "How did you find me?" Sam said. "I met Harry Plowman at Northwood Market. I hope no one tracked you here. I left before it was light. Your father was to tell people I went to Kingsbridge. No one followed me." They talked for a few minutes. Then he said he had to get back to work, or the other men would resent his leaving it all to them. "Go back to the village and find old Liza," he said. "She lives opposite the church. Tell her who you are, and she'll give you some refreshment. I'll be there at dusk." Gwenda glanced up at the sky. It was a dark afternoon, and the men would be forced to stop work in an hour or so. She kissed Sam's cheek and left him. She found Liza in a house slightly larger than most. It had two rooms rather than one. The woman introduced her husband, Rob, who was blind. As Sam had promised, Liza was hospitable. She put bread and pottage on the table and poured a cup of ale. Gwenda asked about their son, and it was like turning on a tap. Liza talked unstoppably about him, from babyhood to apprenticeship, until the old man interrupted her harshly with one word. "Horse!" They fell silent, and Gwenda heard the rhythmic thud of a trotting horse. "Smallish mount," blind Rob said. "A palfrey, or a pony. Too little for a nobleman or a knight, though it might be carrying a lady." Gwenda felt a shiver of fear. "Two visitors within an hour," Rob observed. "Must be connected." That was what Gwenda was afraid of. She got up and looked out of the door. A sturdy black pony was trotting along the path between the houses. She recognized the rider immediately, and her heart sank. It was John O'Reeve, the son of the bailiff of Wigley. How had he found her? She tried to duck quickly back into the house, but he had seen her. "Gwenda!" he shouted, and reined in his horse. "You devil," she said. "I wonder what you're doing here," he said mockingly. "How did you get here? No one was following me." "My father sent me to Kingsbridge to see what mischief you might be making there, but on the way I stopped at the Crossroads Tavern, and they remembered you taking the road to Althenby." She wondered whether she could outwit this shrewd young man. "And why should I not visit my old friends here?" "No reason," he said. "Where's your runaway son?" "Not here, though I hoped he might be." He looked momentarily uncertain, as if he thought she might be telling the truth. Then he said, "Perhaps he's hiding. I'll look around." He kicked his horse on. Gwenda watched him go. She had not fooled him, but perhaps she had planted a doubt in his mind. If she could get to Sam first, she might be able to conceal him. She walked quickly through the little house, with a hasty word to Liza and Rob, and left by the back door. She headed across the field, staying close to the hedge. Looking back towards the village, she could see a man on horseback moving out at an angle to her direction. The day was dimming, and she thought her own small figure might be indistinguishable against the dark background of the hedge. She met Sam and the others coming back, their spades over their shoulders, their boots thick with muck. From a distance, at first sight, Sam could have been Ralph. The figure was the same, and the confident stride, and the set of the handsome head on the strong neck. But as he talked, she could see Wulfric in him too. He had a way of turning his head, a shy smile, and a deprecating gesture of the hand that exactly imitated his foster father. The men spotted her. They had been tickled by her arrival earlier, and now the one-eyed man called out, "Hello, mother!" And they all laughed. She took Sam aside and said, "John O'Reeve is here."
"Hell!
I'm sorry. You said you weren't followed." "I didn't see him, but he picked up my trail."
"Damn! Now what do I do? I'm not going back to Waigley."
"He's looking for you, but he left the village heading east." She scanned the darkening landscape, but could not see much. "If we hurry back to Old Church, we could hide you. In the church, perhaps."
"All right."
They picked up their pace. Gwenda said over her shoulder, "If you men come across a bailiff called Jono, you haven't seen Sam from Waigley."
"Never heard of him, mother," said one,
and the others concurred. Serfs were generally ready to help one another outwit the bailiff. Gwenda and Sam reached the settlement without seeing Jono. They headed for the church. Gwenda thought they could probably get in. Country churches were usually empty and bare inside, and generally left open. But if this one should turn out to be an exception, she was not sure what they would do. They threaded through the houses and came within sight of the church. As they passed Liza's front door, Gwenda saw a black pony. She groaned. Jono must have doubled back under cover of the dusk. He had gambled that Gwenda would find Sam and bring him to the village, and he had been right. He had his father Nate's low cunning. She took Sam's arm to hurry him across the road and into the church. Then Jono stepped out from Liza's house.
"Sam," he said, "I thought you'd be here."
Gwenda and Sam stopped and turned. Sam leaned on his wooden spade.
"What are you going to do about it?"
Jono was grinning triumphantly.
"Take you back to Waigley.
I'd like to see you try."
A group of peasants, mostly women, appeared from the west side of the village and stopped to watch the confrontation. Jono reached into his pony's saddlebag and brought out some kind of metal device with a chain.
"I'm going to put a leg iron on you," he said,
"and if you've got any sense, you won't resist."
Gwenda was surprised by Jono's nerve. Did he really expect to arrest Sam all on his own? He was a beefy lad, but not as big as Sam. Did he hope the villagers would help him? He had the law on his side, but few peasants would think his cause just. Typical young man, he had no sense of his own limitations. Sam said, "I used to beat the shit out of you when we were boys, and I'll do the same today." Gwenda did not want them to fight. Whoever won, Sam would be wrong in the eyes of the law. He was a runaway. She said,
"It's too late to go anywhere now. Why don't we discuss this in the morning?"
Jono gave a disparaging laugh. "And let Sam slip away before dawn, the way you sneaked out of Waigley? Certainly not. He sleeps in irons tonight."
The men Sam had been working with appeared, and stopped to see what was going on. Jono said, "All law-abiding men have a duty to help me arrest this runaway, and anyone who hinders me will be subject to the punishment of the law."
"You can rely on me," said the one-eyed man. "I'll hold your horse."
The others chuckled. There was little sympathy for Jono. On the other hand, no villager spoke in Sam's defense. Jono moved suddenly. With the leg iron in both hands, he stepped towards Sam and bent down, trying to snap the device onto Sam's leg in one surprise move. It might have worked on a slow-moving older man, but Sam reacted quickly. He stepped back, then kicked out, landing one muddy boot on Jono's outstretched left arm. Jono gave a grunt of pain and anger. Straightening up, he drew back his right arm and swung the iron, intending to hit Sam over the head with it. Gwenda heard a frightened scream and realized it came from herself. Sam darted back another step, out of range. Jono saw that his blow was going to miss, and let go of the iron at the last moment. It flew through the air. Sam flinched away, turning and ducking, but he could not dodge it. The iron hit his ear,